Акция протеста в центре Киева переросла.
Там несколько тысяч человек митингуют у Верховной Рады.
В Киеве у Верховной Рады сегодня произошли столкновения между митингующими.
A tent city has appeared in Kyiv for the first time since the Euromaidan. Protesters are demanding that President Petro Poroshenko enact anti-corruption reforms or step down. Pro-Western politicians are squabbling. Judicial reform is stalled. Pessimism and tension are rising. Welcome to the growing pains of something I call Ukraine's third revolution. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks, Brian. Hi.
And joining us from Minsk, where he is apparently on holiday, is RFRL's Kyiv correspondent, Christopher Miller. Welcome back to the podcast, Chris.
Thanks for having me again.
Thanks for coming on. So to contextualize our discussion a bit, I wanted to start out by describing the context I see the recent events in Kyiv unfolding in. The way I see it, Ukraine has basically had three revolutions since independence. The first, nobody else but me calls a revolution, but occurred in the summer of 1994, July 1994 to be exact, when Ukraine had a presidential election, its first post-Soviet presidential election. The incumbent Leonid Kravchuk lost that election, and then he did something absolutely remarkable. He stepped down and let the victor, Leonid Kuchma, take office. That, incidentally, was the first time that happened in the post-Soviet space. The Baltic states at that point had not even done that yet. This set a precedent that in Ukraine, elections are competitive and power transfers are peaceful. I consider that a revolution. The second revolution, popularly known as the Orange Revolution, occurred in 2004, and it basically established the principle of oligarchic pluralism in Ukraine. Essentially, after serving two terms as president, Kuchma and his handpicked successor, Viktor Yanukovych, were trying to cement the power of their clan through a fraudulent election, at which point civil society, backed by rival oligarchic clans, balked. And the third revolution was, of course, the Euromaidan in 2013-2014. And what this represented to me was Ukrainian civil society basically saying, we want to move from oligarchic pluralism to real pluralism, and we're not going to take no for an answer. But this is the hardest step for an oligarchic elite to take. It essentially means they have to have the vision, the foresight, and the confidence to legislate themselves out of existence, to legislate away their impunity and their privilege. Chris, you've spent a lot of time in Ukraine, a lot more than I have, and you watched all this unfold from ground zero. How would you assess, first of all, would you agree with my characterization of what we're having going on right now? And how would you assess Ukraine's movement from oligarchic pluralism to real pluralism? Is the glass half empty? Is it half full? How would you assess the events unfolding right now in Kyiv?
Yeah, I would more or less agree with what you had to say, although maybe take a little bit of issue with your first revolution. And then also with Euromaidan being, or with the idea of revolutions and the transfer of power being peaceful, I'm not putting any of the blame on the Euromaidan revolutionaries, but, you know, that wasn't exactly peaceful.
Yeah, no, but, I would agree with that, and that's the one fly in the ointment there. Although I would say what 94 established was the principle that these elections are supposed to be fair,
yeah,
and transfers of power are supposed to be peaceful. 2014 was the exception to the rule, and I would argue the exception that proves the rule, actually.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and since then, you know, working on your thesis of oligarchic pluralism, You asked if the glass is half full or half empty. I just see the glass as having water in it. I don't want to be too optimistic or terribly pessimistic. I guess I'm somewhere kind of in the middle because, just to look first at the most recent events, like this week, there's another tent camp back out on the streets, not on Maidan this time, but in front of Parliament. And, you know, as little as has been done since the revolution. This week, there was a big bill passed. I think we do need to give Parliament and the government credit for helping push through healthcare reform,
yep,
which I really do think is big I mean, that's certainly, you know, one of the areas where corruption has been incredibly bad in you know, throughout Ukraine's history. And the fact that they were able to push this through does show, I think, that there is still, you know, a group within government and lawmakers that are willing to take risks to still, you know, work on really big reforms.
And they also passed the immunity bill, right?
Well, they didn't pass the immunity bill, no, but they sent two immunity bills to the Constitutional Court for consideration. Now, that was considered by a lot of reformist MPs like Mustafa Nayyem, who was you know, arguably the man who started Euromaidan, right, as being a small victory. Everybody yesterday was saying we want a small victory. And actually, I was on the square outside of Parliament when the immunity bills, there are two, were being discussed. And when they weren't passed, but they were voted on being sent to the Constitutional Court for consideration, there was applause outside. So, you know, it wasn't just some of the reformist MPs inside that saw this as a small victory, but clearly many of the people, you know, applauding around me also saw it as a small victory. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in doing that, I mean, I think they're right. Like it's ingrained in the Constitution, right? This immunity, MP's immunity. So it can't be, the Constitution can't be and shouldn't be changed overnight. You know, there's probably a fair case to be made that Yanukovych had no problem with that. But, you know, in this case, post-Maidan, with, you know, what many deem to be a pro-Western government in charge, I think this is the right step. Now, it's a matter of which of these two bills ends up going forward, I think, shows us just how serious authorities in the government and Poroshenko is about removing this MP immunity, because one bill was put forth by him and his party, and if passed, it would not remove the immunity from MPs until, I believe, 2019 or 2020, whereas the other one, once passed, would essentially remove that immunity almost overnight.
Now, there's the other things. Judicial reform, of course, has been stalled, and that's one of the biggest things that's frustrating the protesters. And the anti-corruption court has been severely watered down, to put it charitably. Correct?
Yeah, correct, correct. I mean, there's been some movement on that, and Poroshenko has conceded some ground, saying that he would ensure that the anti-corruption court was established. But if you remember a few weeks ago when he said that, he said also that there would also be this anti-corruption chamber that would sort of oversee decisions. And should there be some kind of disagreement within the court system, it would ultimately have the final say. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think that a lot of the anti-corruption campaigners that have been really pushing for this see that as a sort of necessary concession on their part. You know, it's better to have the court. Even if it means allowing Poroshenko to still have his anti-corruption chamber, mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, judicial reform is obviously another big one, and there's not a lot of talk of that right now at this new tent camp within those protests. It's kind of wrapped into the big reform push, but the very pointed demands are this immunity bill. The other one is the electoral reform, which wasn't passed. It was discussed yesterday into the evening, but not passed. And that is something that the protesters have said they want seen done, and they're not going to leave their protest camp until it is done. I guess, you know, that's you know, what's happening right now. I like I said, I'm not terribly optimistic, but I think there is some, you know, some reasons to be newly optimistic, having seen pressure put on parliament and authorities this week, and seeing that it can, you know, these street protests still can produce results.
Yeah, no, turn it to Mark. I mean, when we look at the commentary about Ukraine right now, it really tends to fall into these two broad camps right now. You see people like Andreas Umland, who's been a guest on this podcast, people like Anton Shekhovtsov, who's been a guest on this podcast, very critical of the regime. And you have some people even calling it a regime and not the government or the pro-Western leaders. They're beginning to call it a regime, which means something, right? You're starting to have people, some not those I mentioned here, but some saying, you know, this is as bad as Yanukovych. Then you have others, people like Alexander Motil, who put a video out about this last week, or people like John Herbst at the Atlantic Council, the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, saying, hold on a second here. If you really look at the track record on reform, it's been very, very, very impressive. Same question to you, Mark. Is the glass half empty, half full? Does it just have water in it? Are we truly seeing this kind of struggle between a move toward real pluralism away from oligarchic pluralism? Are the oligarchs trying to hang on and preserve the old system? Or what do you see happening here?
Well, of course, the oligarchs are trying to hang on. And I must admit, I could not subscribe to the view that we've seen very impressive reform. We have seen reform, and particularly a lot of it is the tedious nuts and bolts things of actually getting a grip on the economy, which, although inflation is still at about 13.5%, nonetheless, if we think of where it was a couple of years back, I think that there has been progress. But the issue, a couple of points, really. One is elections in and of themselves don't matter. Elections are a mean to an end. They're just simply the process whereby, from the population's point of view, they can create a government that is actually responsive to their needs and their desires and such like. And therefore, I think one of the issues is that even where we are seeing progress, I think it's much more out of either, first of all, a desire to maintain power, a sense of, well, what are the least concessions we can get away with making, rather than because this is right and this is proper.
Do you mean the current government or do you mean the oligarchy writ large?
Well, I would think it would be quite difficult to actually create of a distinction between the two, because this is the second point. Many of the decisions that take place, even which actually are genuine steps forward, actually reflect just simply the shifts in balance of power within that oligarchic pluralistic structure. I mean, take the healthcare reform, which, as Chris absolutely mentioned, rightly mentioned, rife with corruption, the old system. Now, it's not that I feel that there is some broad understanding within the Ukrainian political and economic elite that it's wrong, because we see continual embezzlement and corruption elsewhere. It's more that you might say the interests who were benefiting from the existing situation were not strong enough, did not have enough alliances that it was kind of worth fighting that particular battle, and particularly because this is also an issue and things like the IMF and so forth and also mentioned. So where we see progress, it is, I would say, the result of either infighting within the oligarchy or a kind of a grudging fight every barricade, guard every trench sort of resistance to the pressures of civil society. So, I mean, is this good and bad? Well, it's both. It's bad in the sense that precisely you still have a government which, in my opinion, is dominated by these oligarchic elites. But it's good that even now, after almost 4 years, we actually still have, again, ebbs and flows, but nonetheless, we still have a civil society which is continuing to push, and we still have a population which has not completely lost any hope or expectation of improvement. Now, there are other things that are much more dismaying, but if we're trying to hold on to what is the positive news out of Ukraine, it is that the pressure is still on.
And this has been the story of Ukraine since independence. The civil society has just kept coming back and coming back and coming back. And like I said, it won't take no for an answer. And I would you agree with my contention that we see steady, slow, but steady progress from 91 onward, but I would argue particularly since not from 94 onward?
Well, I mean, I'd agree with Chris's caveat that actually the Maidan, it's all very well sort of trying to sidestep it as, it's the exception that proves the rule. But I think it actually suggested that the initial drive towards, shall we say, a truly constitutional sense of how politics works, I think maybe actually has lost its mojo.
Because of the Maidan? Because I would argue, what did they do after the Maidan? They held elections.
They held elections, absolutely.
Which were deemed free and fair.
And indeed, but we still see a certain amount, or shall I say, coercive forces within the political structure, whether it's on the right or whether it's on the oligarchs and so forth. I think I just would be careful is that there's a danger of assuming that the patience of the Ukrainians is such that they will continue to put up with this. And when things go unconstitutional, they can go in all kind of ways. Have we seen progress? Yeah, of course, we absolutely have. And the very fact of that early peaceful transfer of power, I think, was truly significant. But my concern is that it is very much a sawtooth, in the sense of there's progress and then there's slip back, two steps forward, one maybe 1.5 steps back at times. And the very fact that at the moment we see civil society pushing, but what we do not see is any kind of meaningful alternative national level political actors. I mean, I don't consider Saakashvili, I know we're coming on
to
him.
You will come to Saakashvili.
I don't consider Saakashvili to be sort of a serious player in respect. The fact that we still have Tymoshenko kind of emerging once again as a sort of key figure. And I'm thinking, well, what do you have to do for your brand to be toxic in Ukrainian politics? You know, the very fact that there is a continuing bubbling in civil society, but it's very much at the moment, it is civil society versus politics, not civil society in politics. Mm-hmm. That, for me, is still the key absence.
Let's pick up on that, Chris, and shift it a little over to the jockeying among the elite and the interplay between the elite and civil society. The conventional wisdom as Poroshenko enters his re-election campaign, so to speak, a year out, or a little more than a year out, the conventional wisdom is that he's not going to enact any serious anti-corruption measures, any serious reforms now, because he can't afford to take on the oligarchs before the election. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I think this is going to be a sort of kind of lame duck period where we just won't see any deep, kind of pushes going after some of these oligarchs until after the election, when he's cemented his grip on power, if it happens, if he's able to win again. To go back a little bit to like what Mark was saying, what you guys were saying about Tymoshenko still being around, obviously, and an example I think of you know the oligarchic influence still existing is Igor Kolomoisky, who is himself he wields power in parliament. There was this attempt to muscle him out of his monopoly on the airlines, and that has failed. We saw that with Ryanair having to back out recently. I think that's another good example, actually, of the kind of oligarchs still wielding power, and Poroshenko not doing enough to move them away from that. Obviously, the Privat Bank was a big deal and a big win for the National Bank, for the government. But Kolomoisky is still lurking around. Obviously, Akhmetov still wielding influence in parliament is a big deal. There's still enough of those guys around that it's not going to be an easy task for Poroshenko to get a lot of the things done that civil society wants done. And I think to go, right back to your question, there's just going to be a lot of foot dragging until March 2019, I believe it is.
Now, something else to bear in mind here, and this goes back to my revolution of 1994, that I'm the only person in the world who calls it that, but I'm going to continue to do so, is that incumbents in Ukraine usually lose. The only one ever to win was Kuchma in 1999. Every other incumbent in post-independence Ukraine has lost election. Does that bode? Is that an ominous precedent for Poroshenko? Is there anything that could really challenge him? I see Tymoshenko's planning on running. Saakashvili can't run, but he's out there being a factor. What do you? How do you see this election shaping up for Poroshenko? Are there serious challengers to him out there, and where are they in this whole oligarchic scheme?
Well, I think there are a few serious challengers. If you look at the way the polls are figured right now, if elections were to be held this month or this weekend, I think he would lose, or he would go into a runoff with Yulia Tymoshenko, in which case I believe she would win. But for most of the people who would run, Poroshenko, Tymoshenko, opposition blocs, Boyko, who else? There would be all those guys. Misha Saakashvili can't run. They all Sadovoy? Their polling numbers are Sadovy is likely going to run, although he's been kind of mum on that, but we can probably expect him to run. Still, he's not polling particularly well. Nobody is polling particularly well. Their negative numbers are higher than their positive numbers.
Everybody's.
And, you know, everybody's, I believe. And Tymoshenko in particular, you know, she's never broken this, you know, through this kind of ceiling of, you know, whatever she's at right now, somewhere between 12 and umpteen percent, right? She kind of hangs around right there. What's happened is Poroshenko's numbers have fallen. It's not that Tymoshenko's have really risen all that much. Mm. You know, some of the opposition people, they've had their numbers rise just a little bit, but they're all kind of pulling neck and neck. I actually think it could make for a fairly interesting first round. And depending on who the top two are, if it goes into a runoff, that could be particularly interesting. One thing that would make it really, really fun, and it's probably way too early to say whether or not he will enter the race and announce his candidacy, but you know, Okean LZ singer Slava Varkachuk is out in Stanford right now learning how to govern. And one of the fun rumors that has Kiva buzz is whether or not he will announce his candidacy. And obviously he was an MP before and he got out of it because he said he hated politics. But he would be a fresh face that has national recognition along the lines of kind of like not in terms of governance or even behavior, but Saakashvili, right? Like the reason that he's managed to kind of linger, I think, is because of his he's a recognizable face. His polling numbers are terrible. You know, they're 1-2%, but he's got a loud minority behind him, and he's managed to attach himself for the time being with Batkivshina, Tymoshenko's party.
Right.
You know, him not being able to run, I'm wondering, you know, what he will do come elections if things don't change for the better for him, and he still doesn't have citizenship. Maybe not. He's granted asylum. It's very unlikely he would still be able to run, but whether or not he would maybe attach himself to Batkivshina or another party, you know, I wonder. And in case they do, their candidate does make it, and let's say Tymoshenko wins, maybe there's some kind of deal there where Misha gets appointed, a cabinet position or something.
What do you think Saakashvili's game is right now? I mean, what is he trying to accomplish, and what do he and Tymoshenko get out of this alliance? And there's also rumors that they're being that Kolomoisky is the money behind that alliance as well.
Yeah, there's rumors of Kolomoisky being behind a lot of things. It's a lot harder to know for sure. Certainly Misha is traveling all around Ukraine. He's got a big security team with him. He's rolling around in fancy cars with Georgian plates. I'm not sure exactly where the money is coming from, but he does seem to have it all of a sudden. I don't know what Saakashvili's long game. I mean, his goal is to be president. I don't know how he plans on getting there. He really doesn't have, or at least I don't see, a plan. I think he's just kind of taking it day by day or week by week, and seeing what he can get away with. Attaching himself to Yulia gives him more attention, more support, but it's not a relationship that's going to last. Those two have, you know, their egos just don't.
I don't think Ukraine is big enough for the two of them.
No, absolutely not.
Mark, you're writing. What are your thoughts on this?
Just a few thoughts. I mean, to start by pulling it back, when you talk about Poroshenko taking on the oligarchs, we should, of course, actually say this is Poroshenko taking on the other oligarchs, because he's not exactly an outsider there. And just something that occurred about this business of the immunity bill. So long as the courts remain corrupt, then actually the immunity bill is in some ways a second string issue.
Mm-hmm.
Because as long as the courts are corrupt, then it doesn't really matter if you have your immunity. I mean, it's embarrassing if you have your immunity stripped, but you're still safe. The judicial review is going to be crucial there. But to go on to this point about Saakashvili, and I must admit, it's tempting to say, well, what does he want? Well, a TV camera. His alliance with Tymoshenko will precisely last only so long as he can't stand for president. Because the point at which he stands for president, he becomes a rival. At the moment, I don't think he's an ally. I can't help but think that the train that brought him to Ukraine is almost a little bit of a parallel with the sealed train that brought Lenin.
I knew you were going to go there.
Exactly, because, you know, the Germans let Lenin into Russia not because they were Leninists, but because they just simply thought
that he would
be
disruptive. So you think the Russians brought Saakashvili into Ukraine?
No. I think from the point of view of people like Tymoshenko, it's not that, as it were, they wanted Saakashvili there for his sake. It's just that they knew he would be a useful, disruptive weapon to basically throw at Poroshenko and throw at the status quo. So again, I mean, I think this is it. It's their perspective is instrumental.
Well, throw at the status quo, but from what I'm hearing from this entire conversation is that all of these people are trying to preserve the status quo. It's the people on the streets that are trying to change it.
I should say something, say exactly, but I think, you know, when we say status quo, I mean the political one, in the sense of exactly the current regime. The point at which Saakashvili would begin to become problematic for the system, and certainly for Tymoshenko, then I think is actually the point where he would no longer be considered a useful adjunct. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and that might well be also when the money starts running out. So again, I mean, I think when it comes down to it, we have the situation of two separate political struggles. One is essentially a struggle between oligarchic political interests who are sort of jockeying for position and from time to time may well do the right thing by accident or do the right thing because it hurts their enemies or do the right thing because they're having to buy off civil society. But essentially, none of the key players have, in my opinion, the hearts in the right place. At the same time, though, we have the political struggle of precisely how can the awareness of civil society be brought into the political situation. And the trouble is that does require a degree of disruption. This is why the Maidan was one of these great opportunities, which I won't say has been squandered, but nonetheless certainly has not been used to its fullest advantage, is because you actually have what otherwise is a fairly insulated and powerful closed system. So in this respect, I mean, I think Saakashvili as president, I don't expect to see that at any point.
No.
Or anywhere. But on the other hand, it might be that precisely he is disruptive enough that it creates the pressures which might actually weaken the system. You know, people like to always think that they are smarter, and the people whoever is thinking of using Saakashvili might well prove to have outsmarted themselves.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm going to stick with my optimism and say, even after listening to all of this and participating in all this, when you look at Ukraine at a really, really close range and you look at the minutiae, yeah, it's easy to get cynical and it's easy to get pessimistic. But when you broaden the aperture and step back and look at it from 10,000 feet and look at where it's been and where it's going, I do see progress.
I don't think anyone's denying progress.
And I think right now we are in this this third, but by far the most difficult revolution to undertake, and that is moving from oligarchic pluralism. It's easy to cement oligarchic pluralism in there. That's basically a truce among the oligarchs. Okay, but to get to this point where you're going to legislate away your privilege, your impunity, your existence as an oligarchic elite. That's tough, but the pressure from civil society is not going to let up. I don't see that happening. It's not happened in a quarter of a century of independence in Ukraine, and I don't see it stopping anytime soon. I see the civil society only getting stronger. One thing I did want to turn to before we move to the second half, when we're going to talk about the Donbass, is the big elephant in the room, the Russia factor, as all this unfolds. I mean, a lot of the conventional wisdom is that Russia's just biding its time and expecting Ukraine to fall apart all by itself. Is that what you see happening, Mark?
I don't think they're expecting Ukraine to fall apart. I think that
metaphorically speaking,
no,
politically.
I mean, even politically, I think that in some respects, what they have realized is that Ukraine is, on the one hand, a system that they can't assume that they can control. I think this is, again, I mean, in part, this is the lesson that they've drawn from the failure of their Donbass adventure, and also more generally, the fact that there is at present no one who is a clear Russian candidates.
It's impossible, I think, to have that.
Exactly.
They could have stealthy Russian candidates, and I, quite frankly, would put Tymoshenko in that category.
Tymoshenko, but again, when it comes down to it, Tymoshenko is interested and is a vehement patriot of the state of Tymoshenko.
Yes.
And insofar as it's useful, I mean, in the past, it was quite useful for her to strike deals with the Russians.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it might be in some ways, but again, actually, I think there's a much, much larger risk associated with it. She has absolutely no sentimental or political
affiliation. I think you would see
there
some very, very happy faces on Staraya Ploshchadь in the Kremlin and in the Kremlin if Tymoshenko unseats Poroshenko. I think that would certainly be the case. I mean, even in 2010, they were debating in the Kremlin whether they wanted to back Tymoshenko or Yanukovych.
But the point is,
but you're saying things have changed.
I think Tymoshenko, I mean, would they like to see Poroshenko go? Well, yes, in part, just out of pure human spite. This is someone who, you know, has kind of, you know, played a very rhetorically tough game with them. And also a sense that Tymoshenko is, shall we say, sensible. And by when they say
from
sensible, exactly, they mean someone with whom they might be able to make deals. I just think actually they might find her a rather more formidable antagonist than they might think. Because again, we should realize how often the Russians dramatically mishandle,
yes,
and misunderstand other people's politics. And they are prone to
particularly Ukraine's.
Right. So bringing it back, I mean, I think what the Russians are doing is also, I think they have a sharp awareness at the moment that they can do certain things just to keep the pressure up.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, that's what we're seeing with the Donbass. That's what we're seeing with, I mean, although I don't believe that all of the killings that are blamed on the Russians that we've seen in Ukraine are actually Russian state killings.
But
nonetheless, it is clear that there is a sporadic terrorist campaign being launched and so forth. These are all things part of a strategy of tension. But that said, in positive terms, I think they are struggling to find any levers that they can meaningfully pull to try and influence them their way. So anyway, I think what they are just going to be doing is keeping up the tension and the pressure and hoping that in one way or the other, exactly, Ukraine missteps. I mean, I think what they would love more than anything else is if Ukraine critically mishandles its relationship with the West or with Brussels or whatever, or with the IMF, because these are things that could actually have a serious impact.
Yeah. Chris, your thoughts before we move on the Russia factor in all of this?
I agree almost with, you know, completely with what Mark said. I think to a certain degree, the Russians can bide their time and wait for Ukraine to shoot itself in the foot to some degree. You know, it's not going to lead to a deathly infection or anything like that. To get into that terrible metaphor, but you know, to some degree, Ukraine does end up kind of, you know, screwing up on its own. I do think that Russia has lost a lot of its influence over Kyiv, though, and I think just what Mark was saying, there's no political candidate that they can really count on to, take forward its plans and goals and work Kyiv from the inside. You know, certainly, Medvedchuk has, you know, no broad support, mm-hmm. and there's really nobody within Oppo Bloc who is staunchly pro-Russian, even though everybody would like to believe that this is really a Kremlin front organization. They actually are, if anything, just kind of, you know, pro themselves, pro Oppo Bloc. I mean, they're businessmen. They're not even, they're barely politicians, and there's certainly no ideology there.
What about Tymoshenko and the Russians?
Tymoshenko, I mean, I'll say that I think Mark said something about her being practical or pragmatic or something
yes,
along those lines.
Sensible, I think was the word he used.
Sensible. I'll say that she is someone who, like Mark said, is very much a patriot of the state of Tymoshenko, but is someone who, maybe looking at it from the Russian perspective, if she's not pro-Russian, maybe she's someone that they could see doing business with, right? Like much in the same way they viewed Donald Trump. And we know how well that's turned out for them thus far. Say what you will about Trump and the Trump-Russia investigations, but You know, Trump has signed new sanctions against Russia, and he's not really been the friend that Moscow had hoped he would be. I think that could end up being some, you know, it could be a similar situation should Timoshenko be elected president in 2019.
All right, on that note, we'll shift gears. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and look at the changing tactics in Kyiv and in Moscow toward the war in the Donbas. I'd like to remind you, you are listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galeotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us from Minsk, where he's apparently on holiday, is RFRL's Kyiv correspondent Christopher Miller. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical Podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at RFRL.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
На оккупированном Донбассе время замерло.
Закон о реинтеграции Донбасса не решает проблем оккупированных территорий.
В Москве обсудили ситуацию в Донбассе.
Россия – агрессор, Донецк и Луганск – оккупированные территории.
Донецкая Народная Республика прокомментировала...
After 3.5 years of war, the Russian-occupied areas of the Donbass have become the land that nobody wants. Moscow wants Kyiv to reabsorb the so-called Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics into a decentralized and federalized Ukraine with the separatist leadership intact, where they would serve as a Trojan horse. And Russia's content to keep the conflict alternatively frozen or on a low boil until it gets its way. Ukraine says it'll only reabsorb the territories on its terms after Russian forces have left, the separatist authorities have been disarmed and dethroned, and Kyiv regains control of its border. And Kyiv appears content to keep the conflict frozen till it gets its way, and this leaves the territories in a state of perpetual limbo. But in recent weeks, there have been signs that both Moscow and Kyiv are changing their tactics in opposing efforts to break the logjam. Russia is proposing sending peacekeepers to the Donbas, albeit in limited numbers and only along the contact line, a move described by many as a trap. And Ukraine's parliament, the Verkhovna Rada, has passed legislation defining the territories as, quote, temporarily occupied, called Russia's actions aggression against Ukraine, and giving Poroshenko the right to use force to reassert Kyiv's control. The legislation also gives UN Security Council resolutions precedence over the Minsk Accords. Chris, what do you make of the latest maneuvers by Moscow and Kyiv?
I think it's interesting, you know, to even see Putin suggest peacekeepers. Well, obviously, it's not a good plan for Kyiv, and neither Kyiv nor its Western backers would agree to the plan as proposed by Putin. I think it's fairly telling that he's even brought it up. It's been 3 years, and he's been vehemently against peacekeepers and the idea of bringing in an armed a Western armed group or an international armed group to keep the peace in Donbas. But we're still a long way from anything like that even happening. He's actually backed away, I guess via the foreign ministry, really, not him personally, but kind of backed away from that proposal, it seems now, or at least discussing it any further. It was kind of like an all or nothing, it seemed to be, with the foreign ministry's statements over the past couple of weeks. I think who was I having this conversation with? It may have been Mark the last time we saw each other, but I feel like there's been some movement, and maybe we could take this as a very small kind of, glimmer of hope that maybe Russia is looking for a way out of the conflict. And while this peacekeeping idea isn't, the kind of silver bullet to put an end to this whole thing, maybe it's a sign that there's room to talk and maneuver with Putin right now. I don't think anything's going to happen until after the election, because there's. I don't foresee any scenario in which he can get out right now and spin it as a win, which he'll certainly need to do domestically. But maybe a year from now there'll be some progress on that front. I'm pretty pessimistic when it comes to like end of war. I think this is going to happen. I mean, continue on for a long while. I just don't see. For Kyiv, the cost is way too high. Any kind of concession is going to be very, very costly, and I don't see civil society, especially the veteran groups, you know, standing behind Poroshenko if he's got to make any kind of concession really to the Kremlin. And then again, you know, we've got elections in Ukraine, so it's another reason to think that nothing is really going to happen for at least another year and a half or two.
Now, this has been described by many, most recently James Scherer at Chatham House in an article this week, as a very clever trap from the Russian side. The argument being that this offer of peacekeepers along the contact line is an opening gambit. But imagine Putin were to follow through and allow peacekeepers throughout the Donbas. Then Scherer and others have argued that the onus would immediately fall on Ukraine to fulfill its side of the Minsk agreement and decentralize and federalize and give the Donbas autonomy through which Moscow would be able to exert control or influence or leverage over Ukraine. Just throwing that out there. Mark, you wrote a piece this week arguing that the conflict in the Donbas will be resolved not by the force of arms, but by the force of example. If you want to follow up anything Chris said, but also follow up on that argument you made as well in your ECFR piece.
Sure. I mean, again, I would very much agree with Chris that the suggestion about peacekeepers, I mean, it might have been intended as a trap, though I also believe that the Russians are aware that this wasn't actually going to be an option that anyone would take, not least because you can only have peacekeepers when there is a peace to keep. And I certainly don't think for a minute that Putin would be willing to see peacemaking forces deployed into the Donbas. But nonetheless, I think it's interesting that on the one hand you have Ukraine toughening as well as making more realistic its formal appreciation of the situation, calling these territories temporarily occupied. I mean, that is exactly what they are. Whereas you have the Russians who are twisting a little. I mean, it is clear that they are hurting from this conflict. It's one that they can afford to continue to maintain for the moment, militarily and economically, but it's not a cost that they are not having to sort of do other things to cover up for it. I mean, this is a drain on the federal subsidy budget for the central treasury, and it is clearly a geopolitical cost for Russia. So I think, interestingly, we actually have in some ways a slight, I would say, shift in the balance of power
toward Kiev.
And this is why I'm a little concerned. We also have at the same time a certain amount of rhetorical flourish about the potential of taking back the Donbass militarily, which we've heard periodically.
I saw that as rhetoric. I know you opened your piece for the European Council on Foreign Relations, but with that,
because we had the chief of the general staff saying that Donbass could be taken back in 10 days with 2,000 to 3,000 dead soldiers, and obviously plus more wounded, and also 10,000 plus civilians. But nonetheless, more presenting this as something that was both a done deal potentially, which I would question, but also an entirely viable suggestion. Now, on the one hand, talk to Ukrainians within the sort of government and power structures, there is actually a relatively realistic assessment of the fact that, in fact, the Russians do have escalation dominance. They can always surge in more troops. They can do all kinds of
things. Not only in the Ukrainian elite, you'll have that perception, but everywhere.
But on the other hand, actually, I'm also struck by an unwillingness to rule out this as a policy. And my concern is that at the very time where we precisely have elections beginning to come closer in Ukraine, we have Poroshenko, whose polling figures are very poor, and it's hard to see what else he can really do to actually boost them back up. I think he has boxed himself in quite sort of comprehensively. My concern is there is a sort of begins to become just the temptation of doing something about it militarily, or at least talking in those terms, which creates unreasonable expectations within certain fragments of the population. And when you combine this with talk about sending lethal military weapons to the Ukrainians, which I don't really think is particularly necessary at this stage.
Although it's probably going to happen.
It's probably going to happen, but that's because this is a political and in some ways economic decision rather than anything to do with the sort of situation on the ground. I mean, the kind of weapons they're talking about are essentially ones that would be useful once properly integrated with the Ukrainian military, which takes time, if the Russians were to launch some new major, particularly tank-based offensive. I think the days when that was actually a potential risk are long since gone. So I think for all these reasons, we have at the moment quite an emphasis on some kind of notion of the military dimension and the military solution. Now, I really don't want to say that I think that the Ukrainians are about to launch some kind of attack imminently.
No, I think it's posturing.
But also, nor do I want to sound as if I'm not saying that Ukraine has every right to actually have a military force commensurate with the very real threat it faces. After all, a big chunk of its territory is under foreign occupation. But nonetheless, it takes away from where the struggle really ought to be. And this is really about, because the most important struggles are about governance and economics. A prosperous, thriving Ukraine will be able to do several things. A, it can afford a bigger and better army, if that's what it takes. B, it will actually have a much stronger international position. And C, it will be one in which actually people, whether they're in the Donbass or even in due course in Crimea, will actually want to join. And I think the risk is that by the posturing, even if the posturing isn't intended to go anywhere, the posturing shifts the discussion into basically who is most macho on the military, rather than who can actually address these still, as we discussed in the first half, these still crucial state-building jobs that have not yet been dealt with.
So this is where the two halves of our program kind of meet. Basically, Ukraine would be much better on the military front if it would follow through on this third revolution. And that was, as you were describing, winning the war of governance. Chris, anything to add there?
Yeah, well, I mean, to continue with what Mark was saying, what you just said about, you know, state building and continuing on the path, that Euromaidan set Kyiv on. So by actually going through with the plan, I guess you could say, and committing yourself to these reforms and successfully carrying them out, Kyiv will be a lot stronger for it. So that when the Minsk peace plan does come together and there is the reintegration of Donbass, the Kremlin won't have such a big hold over it should federalization or decentralization, as outlined in Minsk, happens. Depending on who it is, they'll have some who it is leading the Donetsk and Lugansk regions. They'll have some leverage, perhaps, because those people are likely to be pro-Russian or at least anti-Kyiv. But they won't have as much leverage as they do right now.
Chris, what do you make of these laws that just passed the Rada, defining the territories as temporarily occupied, defining Russia's actions as aggression against Ukraine, and giving Poroshenko the right to use force to restore Kyiv's control? Because my first reaction when I read these laws was kind of like, well, duh. It's basically stating the obvious. I mean, doesn't Poroshenko have the right to use force to reassert Kyiv's control now? Hasn't Ukraine always been calling these actions aggression against Ukraine? And isn't it patently obvious that these territories are temporarily occupied? What was the point of passing these laws?
Yeah, I think it's to kind of bring the conflict better in line with international law. The conflict's been defined as an anti-terrorist operation since the very beginning, and the actual control of the military in the east has been really under the security service of Ukraine for the last 3+ years. This brings it officially under the MOD. And does rightfully allow Poroshenko to assert force if necessary, which absolutely they do deserve.
But doesn't he have that power
already?
He
reserves the right to do that.
He's the commander in chief. Doesn't he have that power already?
Yes, I mean they've done whatever they wanted it to, regardless anyway. But I think this kind of saves their butts legally speaking. It provides them, I think, a safer space to operate it.
I mean, I saw the most significant aspect of these two laws as giving the UN security, giving future UN security resolutions precedence over the Minsk Accords. And I saw that as some kind of signaling that some kind of new agreement was possibly going to emerge in the form of a UN Security Council resolution. Am I reading too much into that?
I think that's part of it. I think there's quite a lot to it, actually. I think even there is also a desire. If we're talking, I can provide you the kind of a ground perspective. Ukrainians, I think, have also tired of this ATO talk and have for a long time called the territories occupied territories anyway. So there was definitely a desire among Ukrainians to see these territories defined as Russian occupied territories, which is, you know, the language used in this bill.
Mm-hmm. Mark, I saw your writing. You want to say something?
Yeah, I mean, on Minsk, I mean, you've heard me bang on.
We've all been a lot about the fact of Minsk.
Well, no, Minsk never was. I mean, it was stillborn. But I think again, by moving the sort of the locus away from Minsk and towards the UN. It's not, I think, they necessarily anticipate something new coming out of the Security Council, because we have to remember who has a veto in Security Council.
Well, no, but that presumes there's going to be some agreement.
But again, I mean, I don't think there is any real expectation of that so much as just an attempt to basically take the weight off Minsk. In some ways, to try and suggest that there are alternatives, because one of the reasons why, particularly the Europeans, have still clung to Minsk so tightly is they have a fairly visceral sort of dislike of the sense of any conflict which doesn't have some kind of agreement and structure around it. I mean, bless, it's a European DNA, doesn't like conflicts, and it certainly doesn't like vacuums. And there was a sense that actually you would create a vacuum if you take Minsk out. Mm-hmm. I think it's an attempt to try and say we can actually dispense with Minsk and all mm-hmm. the deeply flawed elements without necessarily implying that it just goes into some kind of primal anarchy. And I mean, therefore, that is also sort of talking to the fact that this is about precisely Kiev's attempt to sell its struggle to the West and particularly Europe. Because, again, this is where I think that actually the focus on the military and however much politicians may like to wear camouflage, particularly when they're campaigning, but it distracts from other constituencies. I was the other weekend at the NATO Parliamentary Assembly meeting in Bucharest, and it was interesting in quite a few of the conversations I was having in the margins, the extent of Kiev fatigue that there was. And although in some ways Ukraine still has sort of strong boosters, certainly in Washington, but also clearly also in Europe. But nonetheless, more broadly, I think the Europeans are less happy with Kiev, more just sick and tired of it. And that, unfortunately, plays very much into the Russians' hands. Mm-hmm. The Russians are hoping in some ways to almost exhaust the groundswell, or drain it, shall I say, of natural and righteous sympathy for Kiev. And by hoping that, exactly in this respect, that Kiev, by backsliding on so many of its commitments, just simply ends up that it has no friends. So I think this is also an attempt to try and sort of show that Ukraine is willing to be imaginative, is willing to try alternatives, and that, in fact, there is more than just Minsk out there as a potential solution for this crisis.
So before we wrap it up, I guess I'd throw two things out there. I mean, are we basically about to see a decisive shift in this away from Minsk and towards something else? And what does that mean?
I mean, I don't think we are, unfortunately. Okay. I mean, I think that the Ukrainians are desperate in that respect to try and break the political deadlock, but I think it's highly unlikely that anything actually will happen.
Chris, your thoughts?
I'll again agree with Mark here and just say that I don't think it's going anywhere. You know, Minsk hasn't worked. Nobody's come up with a great idea since then. I'm not terribly optimistic. Like I said before, I don't think that we're going to get any solution to this or any movement really until at least elections are finished in both Russia and Ukraine, which is another year and a half away. Nobody's even discussing an alternative to Minsk, and yeah, I can understand why they want to stick to it, and they don't want to give the impression that they are considering something else. But it might be time to do so, and maybe that is what they're doing with the UN Security Council thing, regarding this bill. But I'm not terribly optimistic.
Well, that's a happy note to end the program on, but I guess that's what we'll do it. That's about all we have time for today, so we'll wrap it up. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. Joining me here in the studio has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us from Minsk has been RFURL's Kyiv correspondent, Christopher Miller. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening discussion. And I'd also like to thank our producer, Pavel Zabrodsky, who's filling in for the vacationing Tanya Koncheva. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfurl.org. And you could follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noize MC. Yeah, Mike, I just want to say goodbye to Chris. Chris, you still with us?
Yeah. Sorry about the all the phone stuff.
No, it happens.
My connection and whatnot.
It was much smoother than my connection with the BBC this morning, that's for sure.